So the topic, that little discussion, we thought a nice topic would be the five main topics of Bhagavad Gita. So you all know Bhagavad Gita. And according to one of our very great acharyas in our disciplic line, Baladeva Vidyabhusan, there are different ways of looking at Bhagavad Gita, how to understand the topics so it all fits together. But one of our great acharyas, Baladeva, indicates that there are five essential topics, and by understanding these five topics, you can understand Bhagavad Gita. Now, I thought it'd be nice to give you a little appreciation of Baladeva, because if we had a little Bhagavad Gita here, and you open up to the, you know, the beginning of a book, the very beginning, there's a dedication page, often. So when Prabhupada wrote his commentary for Bhagavad Gita and was ready for publication, do you know who he dedicated his Bhagavad Gita to? Baladeva. Baladeva Vidyabhusan. Because in our disciplic line, there are two very prominent commentaries on Bhagavad Gita. Baladeva, and he lived the early 1800s to mid 1800s, in that time frame, something like that. Maybe a little later. And around that time, early to mid 1800s, and I'll give a little background on his life. Baladeva was born in Odisha in a Brahmin family, and from the time he was a very small boy, like you, small boy, he had very profound attraction for spiritual teaching. He learned his studies like that. But his interest was not in his studies. His interest was in deepening his spiritual understanding. So as he grew to about your age, he was very eager, requesting his mother and father, "I'd like to go find a spiritual master, a guru." They were saying, "You have to finish your studies." He said, "I already finished my studies. I learned everything they have to teach me. They don't have anything more to teach me. I'd like to go find a guru." And as he continued very strongly along that line, they could see he was a very special boy. So at a certain age, they gave permission. So he went traveling. And traveling in here and traveling there. So all the way to Udupi, from Orissa to Udupi by foot for a young boy, a young man. Long journey. But he stopped at this place, that place, and finally he found a teacher that he felt could explain all of the spiritual wisdom that he was very eager to receive. And he received initiation in the line of Madhvacharya. Madhvacharya? From Udupi? Yes? You know where is Udupi, right? So Madhvacharya, that was his principal base. And there were nine mutts or temples with Udupi Krishna at the center and the Das avatars surrounding Udupi Krishna. Anyway, in the historical lineage following Madhvacharya, he received initiation in Madhvacharya's line. And he was the best of all the students. So the teacher, the acharya, the spiritual master, was very happy to have such a qualified student and disciple. Because there's a but, because he was from Orissa, and as a young boy growing up, he heard all about Lord Jagannath, and he had never spent any serious time in Puri, he requested his spiritual master's permission to go to Jagannath Puri and take darshan of Lord Jagannath and spend some time worshipping Jagannath. And his spiritual master was not so enthusiastic for that idea, because he was his prime student. But finally he consented, and Baladev then went to Puri. And when Baladev was in Puri, because of the prior history of Lord Chaitanya spending half of his life in Puri, there are many, many associates of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in Puri. And he met one of them. One of them was a disciple of Jiva Goswami. Jiva Goswami, does that ring a bell for some of you? Certainly for you. Radhika Raman did his PhD on one part of the Sandarbhas of Jiva Goswami. So, Jiva Goswami had some students. One of them was Narottam Das Thakur. One of his disciples was Rasikananda, and one of his disciples was living in Puri. So this Gaudiya Vaishnava, follower of Lord Chaitanya, that knew all about Lord Chaitanya, not only Lord Chaitanya, Lord Chaitanya's teachings as were presented by Jiva Goswami and then Baladev, and they met. Oh, they became great friends. And this disciple of the Rasikananda taught him the Sandarbhas of Jiva Goswami. And he was in ecstasy. Because now he understood not only Madhvacharya's teachings perfectly, but he understood now Lord Chaitanya's teaching. They're in the same line of disciplic succession, but Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was specifically teaching about the stage of love that's found in the residence of Vrindavan. Mother Yasoda and Nanda Maharaj and the cowherd boys and the gopis. And the Braja Prema, with the philosophical explanation behind it, supporting it, written by Jiva Goswami in his Sandarbhas. Baladev was very happy. And he heard so much about Vrindavan, he decided he would go to Vrindavan. So he went to Vrindavan. And there in Vrindavan, he met one wonderful acharya, whose name I've already mentioned, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. And he became a student under Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur and accepted him like his shiksha guru, because he already had his initiation. But he just, at this time, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur was he had a title, Sarvabhoma Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. He's the most learned of all the sadhus and all the braja, and everyone knew it. And he was at his feet, learning from him. So in course of time, I'll skip some very important details of history of our sampradaya, but he was called upon to write the commentary on Vedanta Sutra. Baladev was called upon to write that commentary, because previously, in our disciplic line, no one had written commentary. And no one had written commentary because Lord Chaitanya said, the Srimad Bhagavatam is the commentary on Vedanta Sutra, so we don't need a commentary. It's already there. Vyasadeva himself wrote the commentary in the form of Srimad Bhagavatam. But some other personalities outside of Lord Chaitanya's line, they didn't like that. They wanted a commentary. There's details, very interesting. So, under Vishwanath's order, Baladev went to Jaipur for 3 days straight, paid his obeisances before Govindaji in Jaipur, sat up in the temple room and began writing. And the commentary was called Govinda Bhashya. And it was written in a short number of days. So short it was humanly impossible. And he said, I didn't write it, I just Govindaji dictated, and I just wrote it down. Commentary on Vedanta Sutra. Brilliant. To this day, it's studied by scholarly Vaishnavas. And within it is the essence of Lord Chaitanya's teachings as they're found in Vedanta Sutra, expanded in a commentary form, which naturally is like hand in glove with Srimad Bhagavatam. So that's Baladeva. And Baladeva also wrote a commentary on Bhagavad Gita, which Srila Prabhupada used principally for his commentary on Bhagavad Gita, his purports. And so he wrote the dedication page to Baladeva. Because Baladeva was trained in this traditional style of South India, of Madhvacharya, those of you that know a little bit about classical style, there's this system where, consistent throughout all of Baladeva's teachings, he had a vada, a doctrine, whereby it would repeat itself and repeat itself and repeat itself and repeat itself, just like Madhvacharya had his Dvaitavad. When you see pictures of Madhvacharya with his right hand raised and two fingers up in the air, you know who that is. Madhvacharya. Because he taught Dvaitavad. Yes? And in his system, there were five distinctions of, so he called it Panchabheda. There's a distinction between the living entity and God. There's the distinction between living entity and living entity. That's two. Distinction between living entity and matter. Distinction between matter and God. Distinction between matter and matter. Varieties of matter. Panchabheda. And consistent throughout all of Madhvacharya's teachings, up to the very day that he left this world, he was expounding on Panchabheda or Dvaitavad. Classic. But everything had that as a theme. So, in Baladeva's Bhagavad Gita commentary, he did similarly. There are five main topics. So we're going to explore a little bit, because we won't have time to go through it thoroughly. We'll just, so that you have a sense of who Baladeva is, and a sense of his approach to explaining Bhagavad Gita, and so that when you read Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita and purports, you'll have a sense of these topics. Is that good? Little background. We're reading Bhagavad Gita. Of course, Bhagavad Gita, the setting is the battlefield of Kurukshetra, and it's a great dilemma for the great hero, Arjuna, who, before the battle was to begin, he wanted to see the array of the armies of both sides, and as the Krishna drew his chariot in the midst of the two armies, and he saw all the warriors on both sides, and he could understand very clearly, so many people would die, and is this really necessary? And became unwilling to fight, but then submitted to Krishna to instruct him what is his duty, and the result was the great instruction of Bhagavad Gita, right in the middle of Mahabharata, the whole epic. So in that teaching of Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna, we find there are five topics, and here they are one by one. Somehow this is not showing up on the whole page. The Lord, or Ishvara, and the soul, or the jiva, material nature, prakriti, that's three, time is kala, and fruitive activity is karma. Uh-oh, power just came out. Go ahead, you need to put this back in again. So of those five, who can remember why the screen is not up? What are the five? Let's see if you can catch one of them, one at a time.
Karma.
Karma is one. Go ahead. Can you do all five of them? Go ahead, without looking.
Material nature.
Karma. Let him guess. Strain his brain there. The soul.
And Ishvara.
Yeah, that's fine. The soul and God and time and karma and prakriti. That's fine. Okay, there they are. Another question. This is real simple. Well, it should be simple. Of these five, four are eternal and one is temporary. Which is the one that's temporary? Material nature is actually eternal. Sometimes it's manifest, sometimes it's not manifest, but prakriti is eternal. Karma is temporary. So in order to get karma, you need all four of the other ones, without which you're not going to have karma. But karma is temporary. It's very interesting that you have four eternal things to produce one temporary thing. And we're generally stuck over there in the karma realm. Although our real identity is we're part of the eternal realm. And that's a problem. So this evening, unless you don't want to go to work tomorrow, we'll just cover two of the five. And there's a little Bhagavad Gita interactive presentation that we'll add to this that the BBT put together that will help everybody, especially kids, but everybody, to understand the same topic. So I'm going to explain them, and then you'll hear them and see them in a video right after I'm done. So we'll go to the verse of Bhagavad Gita. There's a nice verse in Bhagavad Gita where Krishna describes his separated material energies, bina, prakriti, ashtada. You know this verse from Bhagavad Gita? Bhumir apona lovayu kammano buddhar evacha ahankara ityame bina. Bina means separated. Prakriti. Prakriti means material nature. Ashtada. Eightfold. So Krishna's, this is an illustration by the artist to depict the eightfold material energy, showing the five, earth at the bottom, water, what's happening here? Fire, air, and all around the sky, so that's five. And then that's the five gross elements, and then there's three subtle elements. Mind, intelligence, false ego. That makes up Krishna's prakriti. But also shown in the picture is the soul, right in the middle. That laser pointer isn't working for some reason. It's here, but just doesn't show on the screen. Okay, that the soul, little spark. And next to the soul is Ishvara, or the Atma and Paramatma. Then, of course, there's time. And you take those four, and as long as the living entity has attraction for enjoying matter, then there's fruitive activity. And that's our problem, the desire to enjoy the material energy. So here's some things that Krishna speaks about regarding the soul. Well, these are common sense things about the soul. The soul can be experienced or perceived by the presence of consciousness. Let's say, you know, what's the difference between a living body and a dead body? The soul has left the body. And how do we know the soul has left the body? Because there's no consciousness. You know, from a medical point of view, the heart stops to beat. But there's other things. What the body does, what keeps the heart beating is the presence of the soul. And when the soul leaves, not only the heart beats, but all of the symptoms of consciousness are gone. Like, you know, there's no sensation. Wherever there's a soul, there's consciousness. And conversely, wherever there's consciousness, there's a soul. Which means animals, as long as there's a plant and a tree and a bird and a fish, wherever there's consciousness, there's a soul. And wherever there's a soul, there's consciousness. Many spiritual traditions of the world accept consciousness as being that symptom of the soul. And this other point is that when death takes place, the same chemicals are there. Same chemicals are there, but life is no longer there. That's the difference. The soul has gone. That means the soul is not physical, because all the physical elements are still there. And even in our language, we make this distinction between the covering of the soul and the soul. Just like we say, my shirt, and my shirt is covering my body. We say, my body, and my body is covering my soul. We don't say, I shirt. We don't say, I arm. We say, my. So who's the my? Who's the person? We did this a number of times in classes come to our temples, schools, kids come. It was just in New Vrindavan, and Ohio University had 3 vanloads of, they were like 30 young people from college that came to spend a night at New Vrindavan. It was very nice. So sometimes it's high school kids. So here's what I do with high school kids and junior high school kids. It works very well. If you ever have the opportunity to speak before young people, you can try this. Who in the class is the smartest kid? Everybody knows who the smartest kid is. And everybody laughs and they point to the smartest kid. He's the smartest or she's the smartest. He always gets the best grade. Okay. Now, then could you stand up? Please don't be embarrassed. Stand up. And I want you to demonstrate that you can understand the answers to the following questions. Point to my arm. Point to my head. Point to my foot. And everyone's laughing. My foot. My shoulder. My elbow. Okay. Now point to you. And they go like this. The whole thing. That's me. That means people identify the self with the body. But the language says, my arm, my head, my elbow, my shoulder. There's the object and the possessor of the object. Like you say, my shoe. But you know, you're not the shoe. You're not the arm. You're not the head. You're not the elbow. You're the possessor of those things. So our language even indicates the distinction between the self and the covering, the body. And last point here is in Bhagavad Gita, the body is compared to a yantra, or a machine. Yantra rudhani mayaya. The soul is carried, just like you get in your car. And turn on the ignition and zoom, zoom, down the road you go. You're just sitting there. Or you're in a train that's moving so many miles an hour. You're just sitting there, but you're going so many miles an hour. It's the covering that's the machine that's moving, but the soul is unchanging. As the passenger sitting in the car or train or airplane, the passenger within this body, Krishna specifically describes, the soul is unchanging. Oops. So these are some characteristics of the soul. Now another, this isn't from Bhagavad Gita, but this is some scientific evidence. It's not a proof, but it's evidence that the soul and the body are different. In fact, the soul is consciousness, and consciousness and the body are different. This is an artist painting of out-of-body experiences. You've heard of those? OBEs, they call them?
Yes.
Okay, so for those of you that may not know what that is, sometimes during heart operations, the heart surgeons find that the patient goes into cardiac arrest. Cardiac arrest means the heart stops, and that's death. So they have this arrangement where they put these electrodes on the chest that make an electric discharge that then artificially keeps the heart muscle moving, even though it stopped. So by that system, they can sometimes revive the patient, although their heart stopped. And some of those patients that survived that cardiac arrest and came back alive, when they came out of their anesthesia and the doctor comes to see them, sometimes the patient will report to the doctor that they had one of these, an out-of-body experience. They describe to the doctor in detail what happened during cardiac arrest. One, they're under anesthesia. That means there's no sensation. Otherwise they couldn't live during surgery. But with cardiac arrest, it means because the heart stops, blood doesn't go to the brain. And the brain is where so many processes are being carried out, where people can recognize things. So it's like if your brain was dead, you're not going to recognize anything. During that cardiac arrest, they describe in detail, and there's hundreds and hundreds, skipping details, there's hundreds and hundreds of such reports from physicians all around the world, where the patient is clinically dead, but they get revived by this procedure. And they're describing the procedure, watching it from above the operating table, looking down and saying what the assistant said, what the nurse said, what the doctor said, what they did, the exact details of the procedure, the exact details of their conversation. And through passage, their spatial, their time, their memory retention is acute. It's not spaced out. It's very sharp. And hundreds and hundreds. One report that came from a hospital in Seattle. The first time one woman doctor, surgeon, heard this report, the patient said they went to the ceiling of the operation room, they floated out the window, went up two floors, and they were eyeball to eyeball with a pair of sneakers that were on a little ledge outside the janitor's room. And the woman doctor said, "This is ridiculous." But she wanted to prove it was ridiculous. So she went to that ledge that's just outside the janitor's room, and you can't see it except from the outside. And then the person described everything was inside the janitor's room that was locked. Recently changed things around, and the patient described exactly how things had been changed around in the room. And so she went and asked the janitor, "You know, can you open the door?" And it was just how the person described it. And he looked outside. Well, you can't see it this way, but you can see it from above. There's a shoe, and she described, you know, the little rip by the toe and two different color shoelaces. But when the patient was on the operating table in cardiac arrest, she thought, I don't have an explanation for this. There must be cheating or something or something or something. So there's been studies and studies and studies. And so what's the meaning of this? Why is this important? The soul is consciousness, and consciousness is different than the body. It's different than the nervous system, the electrochemical firings of the synapses in the nervous system. It's different. Those things can go on, and the conscious self is different. Just like we can work through a machine, but we're not the machine. The body is a machine that we work through, but we exist separate from the machine. That's good news, isn't it? And that's the message of Bhagavad Gita. The soul transmigrates through different species of life. Have any of you been to our temple in Los Angeles? Have you gone to this theistic exhibit? Next time you go to Los Angeles, if any of you, there's the temple. And to the left, as you're looking, is the restaurant. And above the restaurant is a really wonderful gift shop. But in between the two is the Fate Museum. Fate, first American theistic exhibition. So they called it Fate. Prabhupada commissioned some artists to make sculptures that would teach people Bhagavad Gita and teach them about Krishna. So this one, I haven't been there in years, but the way that it was set up when I went, it's one of those mylar mirrors. You know mylar mirrors? It looks like a mirror, but actually it isn't. It's a transparent thing. So you go inside this Fate Museum, and one of the exhibits is a huge panel that's a mylar mirror, and you're standing in front of it, and the lights go out. You think you're in India, and it's like, you know, the generator stopped or something. And then you hear this deep resonating voice. Who are you? Did you ever stop to think who you really are? Just consider. And then a little light comes on from behind. Then you can see through the mylar mirror, but only in places. You hear this nice classical music, Mozart music, kind of, you know, very soothing music. And you hear a thud, 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 thud. It's the heartbeat. Thud, thud. And the light, there's a electronic, there's a sharp directed light upon the child within the womb. And his heart is beating. And a light comes on. And then the light moves to the next image. You see a little baby. That light dims and the spotlight goes on the baby. And you hear a little baby, nah, nah, and all that stuff. And then the music is still going. And then it becomes a little boy bouncing a ball. And, you know, children in a playground, and you hear children crying, you know, making children's sounds in a playground and bouncing some balls. And then the music changes and it becomes a little more upbeat, and, you know, somebody's doing sports and so on and so on and so on. It's just the whole change throughout life. Someone's studying his book, and there's this guy holding money, and you hear him jiggling his coins and counting his money. That stage of life. Then it comes towards the end, and you hear some old man coughing. And then he expires, and each one the light is moving. And then what happens at the end? That spark of life that the voice says, and where does that spark of life go? That's who we really are. Not this temporary change of body. During a particular stage, we identify with that stage, but that changes. We go to the next stage, next stage, next stage, and that's not who we are at any of those stages, because our real identity is the eternal soul. This is the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita depicted as the embodied soul. Dehi no smin yata dehe. Komaram yovanam jara. Tata dehantara praptir. Dhira, the sober person, isn't bewildered by such a change. And the soul continues to pass through not only human forms of life, but all species of life. So sometimes people ask, in your teaching, is there an idea of evolution? We say yes. Evolution of consciousness. and not chemical evolution. Because consciousness evolves, and as consciousness evolves, the next life form comes. And the next life form comes. The next life, up to this human form of life, and we receive this human form of life, that's the pinnacle of evolved consciousness for the soul, and so it gets the highest evolved form of body covering. But then with that evolved consciousness and evolved body, we have lots of facility, but we then also have lots of responsibility. Because with facility comes responsibility, right? So this human form of life is meant to be used for self-realization. And that's what Bhagavad Gita is, to help us reach self-realization, to understand the nature of the soul. Who has seen a soul? For that matter, who has seen an atom? You ever see an atom? But everybody teaches about atoms in school, right? But nobody's seen an atom. So how do you know that the atom exists? By its symptoms. Although you haven't seen one, there's atoms, and there's electrons with atoms, the whole of electronics. I mean, so much of our life today is zooming with electronic this and that. Who's seen an electron? But we use electrons and electronics. In the same way, the soul is understood by its presence. And what's the presence of the soul? Consciousness. So we don't have to see the soul in order to understand its presence. We need to understand by its qualities. So here are some qualities that Krishna describes. Soul can never be cut to pieces by any weapon, burned by fire, withered, moistened by water, or withered by the wind. Note that these are earth, fire, water, and air. So it's a non-material entity. Right? It's not part of the Panchabhuta. So it can't be affected by them. The individual soul is unbreakable, insoluble, eternally the same. The soul is invisible, inconceivable, and immutable. Although these may seem so obvious, I could make you all laugh very easily by describing things that I've heard people say what the soul is. Try it sometime. Ask people, do you believe in the soul? And they'll say yes. And then ask them, what's the soul? If you believe in it, what is it? Many times you get that. But there's many varieties of misunderstandings. And from very elevated people. Maybe some of you have read Science of Self-Realization. In Science of Self-Realization, there's a discussion where Prabhupada is having a dialogue with a cardinal in the Catholic Church. As the cardinal is way up there, next, right underneath the Pope is the cardinal. So Prabhupada was speaking with a cardinal, where the cardinal was saying that animals have no soul. And Prabhupada's reply was, where does it say that in the Bible? He didn't answer. He just said, soul means rational faculty. Since animals have no rational faculty, they have no soul. I mean, any animal that I've seen, just like take a cat or, you know, a fox or a... You know, they reason. They know when it's danger, and they run. Right. Or they know, like the Prabhupada's example, the cat waits till the mother of the house leaves the kitchen, then she jumps up on the table and drinks the milk. She doesn't do it when the mother of the household is there. She waits till she's gone and then drinks the milk. Anyway, there's many different ideas of what the soul is. Although you've grown up with this understanding from Bhagavad Gita, it's very important understanding. Further qualities of the soul. There's neither birth nor death of the soul at any time. He has not come into being, does not come into being, and will not come into being. He's unborn, eternal, ever existing, and primeval. He is not slain when the body is slain. Oh, you don't have Sanskrit critics here. Okay, so this is the verse of Bhagavad Gita where Krishna says, as a person puts on new garments, giving up old ones, the soul similarly accepts new material bodies, giving up the old and useless ones. So now we're going to go to the Bhagavad Gita interactive. Hopefully it'll go smoothly. Look at that. And we can have some sound. We need sound before you do that. No, no, not there. Down. Oop. Can we get the sound on? There we go.
You, the soul, the consciousness,
and volume up,
the subtle energy, the self. In the second chapter, Lord Krishna teaches Arjuna that the jiva is indestructible, eternal, and has no past, present, or future. The jiva is transcendental to the material body and material world. Living soul are not the body. The atomic living entity is situated within the heart and is 1/10,000th of heart to the tip of a hair in size. Spirit souls are everywhere. In the air, the water, the earth, and even the fire. As the sun is situated in one place that illuminates the whole universe, so the atomic spirit soul, although situated in the heart of this body, illuminates the whole body with consciousness. The symptom of the soul's presence is perceived as individual consciousness. Only when one revives his loving relationship with the Lord can one realize this happiness.
just put the volume off and go back to the PowerPoint. Okay, so now, along with in the language of Bhagavad Gita, this knowledge that we just heard Krishna describing is confidential knowledge. Now going one level up to more confidential knowledge is making a distinction between the individual soul and the supreme soul. Because when we're born, the soul is not aware of its own identity. The soul is covered and in a condition of forgetfulness. And by some mercy from somewhere, we get to hear about the soul. In addition, there's a distinction between the individual soul and the supreme soul. So this is another topic in Bhagavad Gita, the Ishvara. So on the left-hand side is characteristics of the soul, on the right-hand side, characteristics of the super soul. The jiva soul is individual. There's unlimited numbers. And the supreme soul is within the heart of each individual soul. The individual soul is anu, or infinitesimal, and the super soul is vibhu, or infinite. Each soul is cognizant of their own body. The supreme soul is cognizant of everyone and everything, everywhere, at all times. That's a lot of cognizance. Like information overload. We'd show it circuit, but Krishna can handle it. The position of the individual onto the super soul is one is the servitor, and the supreme is the master, or receiving that service. So this is a very important summary in Bhagavad Gita's message, that in quality, we're cognizant, God is cognizant. So we're quality, qualitatively like God. But quantitatively, very tiny. And God is infinite in quantity. So here's some understandings or definitions of God. Everything that exists comes from Him. This is very basic to Vedanta. Veda, and the end of the Veda means knowledge, and the end of all knowledge is Vedanta. And Vedanta begins with the inquiry into what's the source of everything. Janma dyasya yataha. The absolute truth is, or God is, that from which everything else comes, whatever that is, from which everything else comes, that's God. That's a definition. He from whom everything comes. Everything is dependent upon Him. He is independent of everything. And because it comes from Him, He's the controller of it. He's the proprietor of it. He's the enjoyer of it. And another definition of God is the last line. He has all opulences in full. This is Parashara Muni, the father of Vyasadeva, presents this in Vishnu Puran. That Bhagavan is he who has all bhagas in fullness. All knowledge, all fame, all renunciation, all strength, all beauty, all strength. That's God. And the stages of God realization are realization of the effulgence or the jyoti of Brahman, realization of the localized feature, not just the all-pervasive feature, but the localized feature within the heart of every living being, and ultimately the personal feature upon which the localized and all-pervasive rest. Here's some evidences of Krishna's supremacy from Bhagavad Gita, 10th chapter, Verse number 8, Aham Sarvasya Prabhavo Matak Sarvam Pravartate. Krishna describes, I am the source of all spiritual and material worlds. Everything rests, emanates from me. That's God, by definition. He's disclosing his position as God. Or in the 7th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Etad Yonini Bhutani Sarvanit Yupadharaya. Of all that is material and all that is spiritual in this world, know for certain I am both its origin and dissolution. So there's evidences that Krishna is God. He's the father of all beings from 9th chapter Bhagavad Gita. Aham Bija Pratak Pita. Seed-giving father of all living entities. That's Krishna. Or 14th chapter Bhagavad Gita. Sarva yonishu kauntaya murtaya sambhavantiyaha. It should be understood that all species of life are made possible by birth in this material nature, and that I am the seed-giving father. Okay, so 7-7 Bhagavad Gita. Matak paratram nanyat kinchidasti dananjaya. There's no truth superior to me, everything rests upon me. As pearls are strung on a thread. Sutre manigana eva. Everything is resting upon Krishna as pearls are strung on a thread. And more scriptural reference. So, from Srimad Bhagavatam, from Brahma Samhita. So, Krishna in Bhagavad Gita describes explicitly that the demigods, the controllers of the affairs of the universe, their existence is from him and their powers are from him. They're also resting upon him. Or in the Varaha Purana, this nice reference, Narayan is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and from him Brahma was born, from whom Shiva was born, etc. So Krishna is that supreme. Here's the illustration of Vishwarup. Whatever it is that's found within creation, Krishna is the source of that. He generates from the body of Mahavishnu unlimited universes. In each of those universes he expands into Garbhadakshay Vishnu, who then expands into every atom within that universe. So he's all pervading in the form of super soul, but he has his source of emanation as Krishna, the original personality of Godhead. Krishna, Arjuna declares this after seeing the universal form. You are the supreme Brahman, the ultimate, the supreme abode and purifier, so forth. Krishna is that Ishvara. And that's the next one, material nature. Let's see what happens if we go back to the Bhagavad Gita interactive. And I always prefer having my own computer than someone else's, because I know how my computer behaves and I don't know how someone else's behaves. I end up in a problem. Because mine is directly on the hard drive, and this is remote, so there's a time lag. That's why that glitch. But
Can you copy that presentation to the local hard disk and drive?
There's a time. Persons are getting ready to go. There it is. We're getting all these pop-ups. So let's forget it. We'll do this another time. And see if there's any questions. you maybe better shut this down because it's telling you load battery, even though its power cord is in. Any questions? Or comments? Oh, I'm sorry.
Hare Krishna. What is the role of the wife? I mean, present days, females, I mean, we all think that we are very independent.
Took the wrong topic, sounds like.
I know, there was actually a class in New Vrindavan, but I did not attend it. Which was presented by Prabhupada Village devotees, but I could not attend that.
Okay.
But I want to ask you briefly,
working in Krishna consciousness, what is the role of the wife? While working? Part of the question?
Yes. Working and taking care of family.
Working, taking care of family, taking care of the husband, taking care of the kids, chanting rounds and serving the husband.
Children.
Sounds like you just identified the role of the wife. What do you mean by your question? Is that you're struggling with, you have too much to do and there's too much expectation, it's not realistic?
Is it wise to quit the job and take care of the family in Krishna consciousness, or can be manageable both working and taking care of the family?
That's your question. Okay. That's something the family has to decide. It's not something a third party needs to decide. And for the sake of the children, you know, I'll go out on a limb a little bit and say, because I don't know the dynamics in your home, I don't know what the requirements and the expectations are, but ideal for the sake of the children is that their mother is there for them. If there's some other compelling reason that says one income is not enough, and you need two incomes to maintain, then two incomes. But then what happens when that goes on is the children don't have their mother. And that makes a problem. It can make a problem. When I grew up, I was the youngest of five children, and my mother stayed at home until we were all old enough to take care of ourselves, and then she became a school teacher. So both my mother and father were working. But her job was such that she was back when we came back from school. She was at school and it worked out. I didn't feel I didn't have a mother. I didn't grow up like that. And in our family's case, it was helpful that there was two incomes. But if it's not necessary, it's better that the mother's at home, taking care of especially small children. But in some situations like that, then it's really a family decision. It's not just one person's or another person's decision. And, you know, part of the family is the kids, and how do they feel about the whole thing? And if you have dialogue with children in that way, that you treat them, although they're young, their voice is important, they feel validated and they'll speak their voice. And it's part of the decision making. And I've been in homes where, you know, the discussion was husband, wife, and one boy. And they were talking about, should we live here? Should we live there? Should our son get trained in school in India? And you know, his voice was, whatever happens, the family stays together. Because there was some consideration that he might go to a special school somewhere. And the mother would go with him, and the father would stay and work. And he didn't put his foot down. He just, you know, they asked him, what do you feel? He said, whatever happens, the family should stay together. They liked to hear that. That was a nice message, because he felt validated. He spoke what he felt. So it's a family decision. My personal opinion would be better to live if one income would mean living at this standard rather than this standard. Better to live it so that the family stays strong and you live more simply, that's all. That's my opinion. But it's a family decision, it's not a third party's decision.
You said like we identify ourselves with the body, right? Sometimes we say like my soul. So when you say my soul, is it like it's like a dog interpretation?
It's language again. It's not wrong to say my soul, but in fact we are the soul. Because more grammatically would be I, the soul. And then finish the rest. Because that's our identity. We might use that phrase, my soul, distinguished from some other soul. Because according to Bhagavad Gita, sarva gata, souls are everywhere. They're not just like, 20 souls in this room, because we have human bodies. But within this room, there's so many microbes and ants, maybe, and other living entities, and wherever there's something living, there's a soul. So, my soul might mean, this one as opposed to all the other ones.
I have another question from
you. Yeah.
I can speak a little loud. Maybe it's a dumb question, but the question I have is the case you explained on the operation table, the person is almost a cardiac arrest and his brain is dead. And the soul, outer body experience, you mentioned that he can see and he can grasp every bit of it that he can explain later.
Yeah.
And the question I have is when the body, when we talk about this body, eight elements, we talk about the certain elements, intelligence, false ego, and mind.
Yes.
And if the intelligence is the one that makes the decision and gets the things around it, and that is the one leading the life and giving the directions, what exactly this soul is, where did it get? Once it is dead, the intelligence, everything is dead, the body is dead completely.
No, intelligence isn't dead.
Okay.
There's a distinction between the gross body and the subtle body. And then there's the soul. So in that illustration, the subtle body carries the soul to another position and looks down upon the gross body. When that's the out-of-body experience, or at the time of death.
Yeah.
When the soul leaves the body, what happens to the mind, intelligence, and false ego, or the subtle body? Answer. The subtle body, depending upon what the mind is fixed upon at the time of death, Supersoul arranges that subtle body will carry the soul to the next gross body according to what the mind is fixed upon at the time of death. Whatever the mind, it's Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, whenever the mind is fixed upon at the time of death, the soul is destined to achieve that situation. Whatever it is that we're attached to is what the mind will go to. And whatever the mind goes to, that state we will attain. So, now back to your question. The intelligence is part of the subtle body. Mind, intelligence, and false ego make up the subtle body. In this out-of-body experience, the mind, intelligence, and false ego, or the subtle body, have separated from the gross body, along with the soul, and they're looking down upon the gross body. The soul animates both. The gross body, it's not animate, it's dead, even now. But it appears to be alive because of the presence of the soul. When the soul leaves, it doesn't appear to be alive anymore. It appears to be dead. But the subtle body is still being animated by the presence of the soul. Listen carefully. In the state of liberation, in bhakti, the mind dissolves. The material mind. What a relief, huh? And the intelligence that's directing the soul is spiritual intelligence, or buddhi. The dhammi buddhi yogam tam yena mamopi yantite. The original constitution of the soul is that there is a mind, intelligence, and ego on the spiritual platform. This ego is the sense of identity. So rather than the false ego, it's true ego. The true sense of self. As in aham brahmasmi. True sense of self. And the true intelligence is buddhi. How to get to Krishna. And the mind is there. The capacity to have feelings towards Krishna. Or love for Krishna. On the spiritual platform. But then it's of the soul, it's a property of the soul, as opposed to a covering. The covering is the cause of forgetfulness. Or it's the where forgetfulness, it allows us to become forgetful. So we're awarded material intelligence, material mind, and material ego. Those out-of-body experiences are still identifying with the body. That's my body over there. But when the soul is liberated, it no longer identifies with the body. Does that help?
Yeah, it helps a lot. But still, I have one more to add to this.
Keep going.
It's
okay.
At any point of time, at the time of liberation, after the liberation, is the soul ever be alone without this subtle body, like mind, intelligence? I understand the intelligence towards Krishna and the bhakti and to the mind to attain Krishna, thinking of Krishna. They all participate in Krishna, but can ever be soul alone without these three elements?
Depending upon how you're using the terms. Mm-hmm. The answer will be yes or no. The material covering, the answer is yes. It'll be without the material mind, material intelligence, and false ego. The answer is yes. But the answer is, there's the soul, the covering is there because it's there in the original position. The soul has intelligence. The soul is intelligent. So the soul would not be without intelligence. Because the soul innately has intelligence, sat and chit. Cognizance is there with the soul. So your question, that answer would be no. Because material intelligence is gone, but spiritual intelligence is operative of the soul. Not inseparable from the soul. You can't separate the properties of the soul from the soul. any more than you can separate, you know, sweetness from sugar or heat and light from fire. It's properties of the soul. Because, go the other direction, because there's that property of the soul, when the soul becomes covered, it exhibits a covered feature. Like, you know, a glove and the hand that's inside the glove. Because the hand's inside the glove, the fingers can wiggle. Take the hand from the glove. It looks like a hand, but it's not. It's a covering of the hand. But the hand can wiggle. So, there's another way of saying the same thing is the 15th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Whatever we find in this realm is a reflection of what exists in its pure state in the spiritual realm. This is but a reflection of that. So because there's material intelligence here, it's an indication that there's spiritual intelligence, etc. Because there's personality here, there's in its unadulterated form, there's personality in the spiritual world. There's form here, there's unadulterated form in the spiritual world. There's knowledge here, and it's unadulterated. Whatever exists, as the saying goes, as above, so below. Or the reflection and the object from which the reflection comes. In the reflection, everything that's there in the object can be found in the reflection. Here's a mirror, here's an apple, here's the reflection of the apple. Except that there's no substance. So, go back to the intelligence question. There's intelligence of the soul. That's never lost. Nor would we want it to be lost, but it's not lost. It's not possible. It can be suspended. In Sanskrit, there's susupti. And susupti is, an English translation is deep sleep. Like one who is under anesthesia. But when someone is under anesthesia, does that mean there's no consciousness or it's just put to sleep or suspended? It's the latter. And after some time, consciousness is restored because consciousness is intrinsic to the soul. Take the soul out of that body, put him in that, you know, floating above the operating table. Intelligence is there. Consciousness is there. In a liberated state, intelligence is there. Consciousness is there. But unadulterated. Not the covering kind that we're accustomed to.
Thank you, Prabhu. Yeah, I understand. I think now it can make sense. Yeah, I read one of the sloka in Bhagavad Gita. Now it make more sense to me now. As soon as we come in contact with the material nature, the love and so far we have in the spiritual world that turn into kama krodha because of the material touch, you know, because of the nature touch.
Yeah.
So now it makes sense like...
Well, it's specifically because of the mood of trying to enjoy prakriti. Because you can be in the world but not covered. One can be moving about the world and be in a liberated state.
Yeah.
It's in the spirit of trying to be the enjoyer, the false Purusha. That's the problem. Then the covering. Something in the back? I don't know if we need the microphone. People that have nice, strong voices here.
Each and every soul is different from... the powers of the soul are different?
Well, yes. The personalities are different.
Yeah.
We're individual in that sense. But it's true that in our conditioned state, our abilities are different, but also in the liberated state. Prabhupada's teaching is that variety or variegatedness, variety is the mother of enjoyment. We like to eat, but some we don't like to eat only one thing. We like to eat different things. and that's nice, and that's nice, and that's nice, and variety is the mother of enjoyment. So, on the spiritual plane, Krishna's the supreme enjoyer. And there's so much variety. And the living entities are for Krishna's enjoyment. So one has this quality, one has that quality. One has another quality. And it's all meant for Krishna's enjoyment. So there are various features of living entities in the spiritual realm, yes. All to enhance Krishna's enjoyment. That's our reason for existing. And in fact, there is variety.
Means with the intellect, means like, with the, means if suppose the person will kill an ant, means will kill an ant by accident, with the soul, will it interact to him, or means I'm just asking.
If we unintentionally kill an ant, what happens to the soul of that ant?
Yeah.
The soul of that ant goes on to another life form, because that life.
Does it interact the same body or?
Okay. By nature's arrangement, the answer would be yes. By nature's arrangement, there's a natural duration of life for each life form. But also, because each life form has its predators, when the predator destroys the body, then that soul moves on to the next life form, if it happens by nature's arrangement. So he'll go on, the soul will leave that ant's body and go to whatever the next level of species is for that soul to move on to, and on and on and on, in evolutionary cycle.
Never interact with the same person or something like that.
It depends.
It depends.
Like, let's say, according to Vedic wisdom, if there's murder, a deliberate, intentional act of taking the life of another living being, say even an animal, a cow, according to the Vedic scriptures, for every hair on the body of the cow, one will have to take birth as a cow and be killed. There's a lot of hairs in the body of a cow. A lot of cows being killed. So that's a long sentence. And so the one who does the act of killing will be in the situation of receiving the same punishment from the very hand of the person, or at least can. The person can say, no, I don't want to do that. But they can be the recipient of death from the one who gave them death in their previous life. It's very complicated. It's not like, you know, a very linear thing. It's a very complex thing. But one who is the instrument of my karma, later I may be the instrument of their karma. It's very, very involved. Very complex.
Are there any scarcity of bodies or the living bodies? If the soul gets, if the next body is readily not available, what does the soul is? Is wandering around? Or exactly?
Well, two things. What is coma is exactly what you described. You know what a coma is?
Uh-huh.
What Prabhupada has taught us is that when a coma happens, sometimes people come out of coma and they just come back and live for some longer period of time. But sometimes they're in a coma for a long time and then they're gone. So the coma is the next life situation is not yet determined. So they're waiting. They're in a waiting room. Waiting lounge. And neither are they here nor are they there.
Yeah.
And then when the next body is determined, then it's released. The soul can... Because when the soul leaves the body, immediately it's transferred to the next body. There's no time lag. So if your question was, if the next body is yet to be determined.
Mm-hmm. So accidentally killed in between or something, his lifespan, as we mentioned earlier, each living entity has a lifespan, say 100 years, 20 years, 5 years. accidentally it was killed in between.
Yeah.
And so his half life is left. So he takes a temporary body.
Yeah.
Something quickly available.
Yes. Yes. Like that.
Time being.
Yes. Then there's another situation, which it ends up in a ghost body. So ghosts or Buddhas are living entities that committed suicide or something like that, some kind of traumatic death, and there isn't a body yet prepared for them, but it's not a coma situation, it's they're gone from that body. So they have to, for some duration of time, remain in that subtle body. Here we are with the subtle body question again. So the mind, intelligence, and false ego, that's a subtle body, carrying a soul. That's what a ghost is. So it's possible to be removed from the body, but not have another body to enter. And it's very painful, because they want to enjoy, but they have no instruments or no senses for enjoyment. So they want to possess another body so they can enjoy. That's what makes ghosts very scary.
Yeah, I understand that. Maybe that's why people make stories or something like, it is coming into you, give the body kind of thing. So
I never heard those ones, but
you know, I have seen so many, like, you know, many people talk about, okay, he got the ghost and he got something, and you know, because he's behaving so unnaturally, he's talking and doing all that.
Well, some of that's real.
Yeah, you know, because the next one is, you know, maybe it's forcing him to get, you know, give up the body.
Yeah. So sometimes ghosts will inhabit trees, sometimes they'll inhabit objects. Sometimes they'll inhabit a sleeping body. So there's lots of examples like that. Some, they just come and, you know, try to possess someone. Anyway, something that can prevent that, let's just say, I don't know if anybody here has had the experience of some ghost attacking them, but you just chant Krishna's name and at once they're gone. At once they're gone. When we, I'll tell a ghost story. We bought a building one time in Manhattan. It was owned by Catholic Charities. And it was a old age home. And on the second floor was the terminal room, the terminal floor, that were patients that were going to die. That's where they stayed until they died. So there were some rooms that were like, whew, there are a lot of ghosts in those rooms. And they would, you know, spook the devotees. So we learned how to, you know, if those entities came, because they were there. It wasn't like, oh, some story from a little children's book. Those guys were there. And some of them were very angry. They're very mean. And you just chant and they're gone. They can't stay. Can't stay. So we did a lot of chanting in that building.
They must have been relieved.
Huh?
They must have been liberated.
They were relieved. But, you know, there was one really mean one that he didn't, I don't know what happened to him. how he didn't get the benefit of chanting and get liberated. He kept coming around and causing real havoc. A real mean guy.
Maybe he needs more chanting, like more.
Well, he has more. You should invite him to come to Mangalarti and
more.
It was real mean.
Prabhuji, when we die, if our karma, I mean, what we did in this life is really very bad, we go to hell. Right? And how are we punished in the hell? Right? Like, does the soul feel the pain and...
You ever have in your dreams, you ever have something very frightening and horrible?
Very few times.
So it's like that? That is to say, it goes on the subtle plane, because the gross body has been left. And on the subtle plane, one receives this terrible experience. In hell, is it seems to go on for a long time, but actually it's a short time. Because, like, you know, time is relative. On Brahmaloka, one day is, you know, 1,000 yuga cycles, or the heavenly planets, one day is 6 months, and one night is another 6 months, or one full day and night is 1 year. So go, keep going down. And, you know, what for us is just a moment is a whole duration of time in the hellish planets. So it's suffering that seems to go on endlessly, and to the point where one, this is what the Bhagavatam describes, one is pleading, get me out of here, I'll take any form of existence. So when that's hell, then one takes a life form and a gross body, as a body of a worm or a body of a pig or a body of a whatever it is. But it's a place where people go and they suffer. It's a place. It's not just an imagination, you know, something imaginative. The hellish planets. And the details of that are described towards the end of the fifth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. And it's so awful that Maharaj Parikshit, when he hears it, his first response is, what can be done to help living entities not have to experience that? Even they've done something sinful, and they deserve that suffering. What can be done to counteract so they don't have to experience that? And that's a very nice answer. I'll let you read it. It's the theology of the holy name in the first chapter, Canto 6. There's this, that, but the ideal thing is devotional service, even if imperfectly performed, or chanting, even if imperfectly performed, because it completely relieves one of the karma, or the reaction for those sins. And there's nice discussion about the theology of the holy name. So this, the story of Ajamila is told, where he also had so many sinful activities. But he just unintentionally called the name of the Lord Narayan. And at once he was relieved of all the reactions of all of his sins. He would have had to go experience hellish planets. He was relieved. And it was even unintentional. So what to speak of cultivating pure chanting. Very nice discussion. Very important part of our teachings. Sixth canto, the first chapters. Yes.
There are a lot of resources in the earth.
So yes.
Why the people are the people are not getting sufficient things for each and every one? I don't know.
Why they're not getting sufficient things for each and every?
Yeah, means
each and every what? What was the last word?
Yeah, there are a lot of resources in the earth.
Okay.
And why the people are still suffering with the economy or something? Means they can develop big industries. Right?
Why are they trying to do that? That's not your question.
No, the people. Some people are not getting.
They're not getting what they require.
Yeah. No. Means there are a lot of opportunities out there on the earth and in the solar system.
Yeah.
So, but still the people are suffering, some people.
Well, you know the answer to that.
Means not getting the sufficient resources or something?
No, some people have and some people have not. And why? Mm-hmm. What's the answer? Karma, right?
Okay.
Why is one child born in an opulent and another child born in an impoverished situation? Yeah. Something to do with their previous life. And then, in ongoing fashion, someone that's born impoverished can become very opulent. Someone that's very opulent born can become impoverished. It has to do with how they lead their life. And it leads, you know, brings consequences, favorable or unfavorable. Although the resources are there, as you say. And if we disregard God's plan for the use of those resources, that's where you know, suffering goes, or our situation of well-being goes down. Anything else? Lively group tonight. Yes.
What's the origin of the soul?
Origin of the soul. Krishna. As Krishna is eternal, the souls are also eternal. As Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, there's no beginning to the soul. The soul is eternal. But the soul has its origin in Krishna, who is eternal. So it's not like once upon a time Krishna existed and he looked around and thought, gee, something's missing. We need some souls around here. And then generated some souls. Not like that. As Krishna is eternal, the souls are also eternal. They're part of Krishna. As sparks are part of a fire.
But at the same time, we are separate from Him.
We're part of His energy, but the energy... What's the difference between... There's no separation between the energy and the energetic. Or like this. The sun and the rays of the sun. They're inseparable. See if you can find a sun ray somewhere apart from the sun. No such thing. And a soul is part of Krishna. But the energy, it's Krishna's energy. It's in the seventh chapter of Bhagavad Gita, it's His aparayamitasvanyam prakritim vidime param. It's His para prakriti, but it's His prakriti. So it's His energy. The energetic and the energy, they're inseparable. But the energy is not the energetic. So you can say separate, but inseparable. Distinct, but not separable. Because the category is different.
Follow-up question to that is, so how we get separated from Krishna? Is it because of karma?
It only appears that we're separated from Krishna by illusion. Actually, we're not separated from Krishna. We're eternally Krishna's part and parcel. We're not separated from Krishna. Mami vamsa jiva loke jiva bhuta sanatana. Jiva bhuta sanatana. We eternally. Eternally means right now. Because we've turned our attention away from Krishna, it appears that we're separate. Prabhupada gives this example. You're looking at the sun and all you see is light. Turn your back to the sun and all you can see is shadow. Although the sun's there, you can't see because you have your back turned. We're not separated from the sun. We just turned our back to the sun and we're seeing shadow. We're eternally connected to Krishna. We're covered by forgetfulness. But not separate from Krishna. Just forgetful of Krishna. So all we have to do is turn around and face Krishna. And there we are. That sense of being separate is gone. It's a false sense of separateness. We're not separate from Krishna.
How did we get the forgetfulness in the first place?
Classic question. There's one very nice purport in the 13th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. I'll just summarize. Prabhupada advises that we don't try to understand the answer to that question in our conditioned state because we won't be able to understand it. But when we become free, we can understand it. But the essence of that question you just asked is misuse of free will. Listen carefully.
Yeah.
Free will. The living entity has free will. eternally. The living entity having free will can be in harmony with Krishna or turn our attention away from Krishna. What's prompting that free will choice? Our own free will. Not something outside of, but our own free will. So we can choose, and we did, to try to enjoy separately from Krishna. It's a free will choice, and we made it. It was a bad choice. Because that took us away from our relationship with Krishna. At least, you know, in conscious awareness of our relationship with Krishna. The cause is our misuse of free will. Why would we make such a choice? And the answer is, it doesn't make any sense, does it? It's not a good choice. We misused our free will. Well, why did we misuse our free will? Because the potential to do so is there, and we did so. The explanation that Prabhupada gives is like this: the living entity is called marginal potency, the tusta. The classic example of what does marginal mean is where the river and the river bank meet. So on this side is the river, and on that side is the river bank, and that little line where the river meets the river bank, that's tatasta. So, and that little line, is it river or is it land? It's neither. It's tatasta. And that's the living entity. We're tatasta shakti, or marginal potency. Marginal potency. That says we have the capacity of free will, and we can direct our free will toward Krishna or direct our free will away from Krishna. And we chose away from Krishna. Bad choice. And we're taking responsibility for that. But the capacity to do that is innate within the soul. And we made that decision. And now we're trying to restore the proper use of free will, again in relation to Krishna. That's what Bhagavad Gita's message is. Through various systems of yoga to again link with the Supreme. You alright?
Yeah, I'm good. Actually, I had a lot of questions. I think it would keep going, but I don't want to. Actually, I have a follow-up question.
Okay.
Because it goes forever, maybe, you know, I'm too much.
We'll take two or three more questions and we'll call it a night.
Okay, if that is the case, I'll go next. And, because once we get liberated, we get the, you know, we made a bad choice. We came here, we struggled. For Krishna's mercy, we get in touch with the devotees and we are part of this Krishna conscious. Now we are trying to revive. We are trying to go back, and it is very clearly mentioned in Bhagavad Gita that once we take this process, we will definitely go to, you know, Krishna Loka, Goloka, whatever.
Once we perfect the process, yes.
The process, we go there.
The next question is?
The next question is, we were there in the first place, we made a bad choice.
Okay.
When we go to the second time there, is there that we don't make the second time the bad choice, or because of the first time the choice experience, can we carry forward? And
I have heard this question hundreds of times.
Oh, thanks.
So it's not the first person to raise the question. You'll be happy to hear that.
Definitely.
Okay, and I'll give you two pronged answer. The first one you're not going to be satisfied with. The first one says, this is Bhakti Vinod Thakur, to place the event of misuse of free will within time is misleading. We think of events as within time, but this is not an event within time, although it's an event. What? Could you say that again? Sure.
Yeah.
Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, Do not ask the misleading question, when was the living entity created? Nor the misleading question, when the living entity was enthralled. Because it's not an event within time, although it's an event. We are accustomed to think of events in terms of time. Past, present, future. We don't have in our conscious awareness events that are different. Although there are events that are different. Like Krishna's pastimes are different. And the fall of the living entity is different. It's not an event within time. Although it looked like it. And how else can we think of it? Because the way you described it was, the very language you used was, first time, second time. In the past, present, and future. So, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, do not ask the misleading question, when was the living entity created, nor when was the living entity enthralled? Because it's an event that's not within time, as we know time. The word that's used in Bhagavad Gita, in that 13th chapter that I mentioned, is anadi. There's two ideas of anadi. One is, you can't go back and back. Go back in time and try to trace out the beginning, which is what you're trying to do with the power of your mind. When did that event happen? And it's not an event within time, so you never reach the end. When it happened, because it's not an event in time. Although you'd like to, by power of speculation, stretch the mind to that point in time when you comprehend that point in time, but it's not within time. And so you won't be successful. But it is an event. There are events that are not within time. As the creation of the living entity. But it's not an event within time. Krishna and... So, second, it'll probably be more satisfying. Krishna gives a promise. And Krishna keeps his promises. Krishna's promise is, when you return, I will protect you. It's not like Krishna doesn't, okay, if we look at it as an event within time, then we go, the first time Krishna didn't give his promise, the second time Krishna is giving his promise, hey, what's going on? But because it's not an event within time. But Krishna will, another way of saying the same thing is we've learned our lesson. In order to go back to Godhead, and it's deliberate, back to Godhead, makes it sound like once upon a time we were there and we're going back. But back to Godhead is a state of consciousness, and we will not, it's so precious, we will not be able to go back to Godhead unless we've completely learned our lesson. So it's like, say, children. Children can be, supposing they pick up something they shouldn't have. It's, you know, a piece of broken glass. No. And all you need to tell the child is no, and it's yes. You know, they want it. All the more reason they want it. But no. No, no, no. And then you're not looking, and then they got the thing again. So when it's no longer no, but it's yes. Permanently. We've learned our lesson. It's yes, say yes to Krishna. Whatever Krishna wants. Because constitutionally, that's our nature. We're yes men. We're Krishna's servants. Whatever Krishna wants. In Nectar Devotion, it gives the example of Pradyumna. Krishna's son, Pradyumna. Pradyuman. I've learned it, Pradyumna. 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 Pradyuman. Okay. So, according to Nectar Devotion, when Krishna wanted something and Pradyuman didn't want that something, he would want that something. It would be yes. And the other way around. If Krishna didn't want something and Pradyuman wanted that something, it would be no. Because he was in the mood of serving his father. Dasya, rasa, the mood of service, is simply for the pleasure of the master. And to go back to Godhead, minimally, that must be restored. Then there's higher rasas of friendship, parental affection, conjugal love, but minimally that one. Otherwise we can't go back. So we've learned our lesson. That's Prabhupada's explanation. Now this mental speculation might say, well, if, you know, so many ifs. and all of those ifs, before you say them, or before you even, you know, go through the mental process, you're placing the event within time. If that condition existed before, why going into the future would prevail, whereas before in the past didn't. It's one of those things that the power of speculation cannot comprehend. The mind cannot extend itself and extend itself and extend itself and to accomplish something that's anadi. But at the same time, it's knowable. It's knowable through devotion. Just like one of Krishna's names is Adhoksaja. Aksaja means eyes, and Adhoksaja is Adha. He's beyond the eyes. But so how can you see Adhoksaja? You can't. If he's Adhoksaja, he's beyond the range of the senses. But he's seeable through devotion. Same. This how the living entity question that you're raising is understandable through devotion, not by speculation. You can keep trying, but you'll never get there because it's beyond the limits of the mind. But it's still knowable. It's inconceivable, but knowable. When Krishna discloses it, then we can know it.
Akshaja is
ice.
Akshaja means
ice. Aye, yeah. Beyond the range of the senses.
I put my son's name as Akshaja.
Ah. Akshaja, okay.
Yeah, he born recently, 2 months ago.
Ah.
Oh, that's good.
I see. So
Akshaja can't
be. Okay. And Krishna is Adhoksaja.
It's beyond.
Beyond the range of. Anything else? Ladies' side? Okay, we're done.
Last question. Is it humanly possible for a man to go to other stars?
To other stars? Sure, would you like to go? We may not be able to go in this body, but we can go. Prabhupada, in his a small book that he wrote when he was still in India before he came to the West, was Easy Journey to Other Planets. And in that book he writes the reason that the space travel, because it was going on when he was in India, is of such interest to people is because it's our birthright. We have the potential to travel to other planets. But we can't just use spaceships to get us there. We have to use more subtle means. And to enter some higher planet, we have to have the quality.
Yeah.
So, but it's possible, sure. But not, you say, in human existence, we would have to, generally speaking, we have to give up this body and accept another body. It's possible also by astral travel to go, and you don't have to give up this body. Just go take a vacation. by astral travel, and you go there and you come back. What mystic power. One can do that. Durvasa Muni and so on. Durvasa Muni had that capacity, for example. Okay. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Yeah.